discuss in a related context, in the context of electromagnetism. But let me now go and describe how we achieve some desired properties, desirable properties for the iteration of Einstein's equation. So some of it connect with what Franz described yesterday, if you were at his talk. And then hopefully we'll get a better idea of how and why some things are done. So let me just start first with the harmonic evolution system. And this is something that Franz already described. But let me just do a few set of extra manipulations on that so that we understand why is it we're going to do something to modify the equation so that now the constraints will behave in a manner that we want. So for simplicity, let me discuss vacuum. So we can imagine that we're interested in this equation. And now let me just expand. So if we expand what RAB equals 0 is, what we find is that the equation is now given by 1 half GCD DC BD of GAB. Okay, so the Ricci tensor can be written this way. This is where we recognize some of the components, so of the terms that we have in here. First, the last term, this, which is a combination of terms, we immediately realize that it's part of what we have been calling lower order terms. Which was another way of saying it, they do not belong to the principal part. They do not contain our main variables with respect to the highest derivatives. The highest derivatives of our main variables being the metric, appear in second order or differentiated twice in this first term and in the second term. And in this first term, what we have is a simply, what would amount to the wave equation, if you want, as far as the principal part of the system is concerned, for fields that are given by the GAB. So at this point, it's like we're losing the notion that GAB is a tensor. We can imagine that GAB is a collection of thin scatter fields, which will then we reinterpret as a metric. But from this point of view, then we'll say this is the closest we can get to having just a simple wave equation propagated on a background metric that is given by this GCD. So this is naturally hyperbolic. Not only is it hyperbolic, but it's the best of possible hyperbolics that systems that we can have. So it's strictly hyperbolic and symmetric hyperbolic because the metric is symmetric. And if it weren't for this term, our system would be great. And this is the term that is offending because it has now second derivatives that we have to analyze case by case or in a more with a more complicated kind of procedure where it affects in any negative way this property that otherwise is as good as it could get. So we want to get rid of this or change it in somehow. And we can do it in many different ways. One way is to say, well, let's assume we choose a coordinate condition. So if we choose, say, gamma b is equal to 0. So this is a trace of the Christoffel symbol. We know we have four guys here. We haven't done a splitting of 3 plus 1. So this is the space I'm seeing as a whole. Though in the back of our minds, we will be thinking that this t, the time coordinate that we may introduce is related to the same time coordinate that we introduced to label this space-like hypersurfaces. And we can go back and forth between one representation and the other one, and we'll discuss a few things related to that today. But these are four conditions. So we know we have at our disposal four coordinate conditions that we can use to choose this equal to zero, and this is the harmonic system. Alternatively, well, let me put the alternative further out. We can promote these variables that are otherwise tied and given by combinations of the metric and derivatives of the metrics to its own variables. So alternatively, we can promote this comma b to their own variables, in the sense that we're going to have to evolve those. We're going to have to introduce evolution equations for these gammas somehow, and then treat them as new variables that obey a particular constraint. And the constraint would be given by, okay, GAP is the trace CD, comma BCD of the Christoffels, where we write this in terms of GAP. So what we do is, well, we think that we have more variables than we truly have. We introduce further constraints. But now by promoting this to their new own variables, we maybe have a way to influence the evolution. But more importantly, once their own variables, these guys are no longer part of the principal part of this equation. They are given by some other variables. So if gammas, let me just say this again in a different way, if these gammas were their own variables, we would be seeing these ones just differentiating once, while these ones are differentiated twice, and we can ignore the influence of these guys as part of the principal part of the system. This looks like a little bit of black magic, but remember, when we're doing this, we're paying a price, which is we have new constraints to satisfy, and then this will have to be addressed in a proper way. Just incidentally, we're talking a lot about Girard's harmonic. This is the system that Francis uses in most of his works, the same that I mainly use in most of my works. But there is another family of formulations of two Einstein's equations under name PSSN, by essentially it's a formulation given by Shibata and Nakamura, and with some slight tweaks added by Van Gorder and Shapiro. But this is also one of the most common approaches that people are using when dealing with binary black hole spacetime, and for instance, Miguel here uses that one in most of his works. And in essence, what they do is precisely this trick at the level of the 3 plus 1 decomposition. These gammas, or some variables that are related to these gammas, are promoted to their own variables to essentially affect exactly the same thing. You take it out of the principal part of the system and augment the system of equations. Here, an extension of this, and this is what we have already discussed with Franz, is to consider that gamma b is given by some other functions, hb, where these are known functions, or given by appropriate equations. So you say, these h's are source functions. They're either given by hand analytically, say h is equal to 1 over r or whatever, and we can discuss how you would obtain those. Or you can say these h's will obey another set of equations that I give by hand. And from that point of view, notice that this and that become the same. Here I'm saying gammas, they're their own variables. I'm going to provide some other equations to give them. Here I said, well, the gammas are some h's, and I'm providing some equations for h. So there is a very clear connection between one and the other one, even though at the superficial level and, well, some steps deep, they look to be significantly different. At the very deep level, they are both exploiting the same kind of freedom. But that's not what I want to discuss today. What I want to discuss today is, what do we do with that equation? So one problem that we have, so we know this equation is time reversible. Right? We know that if we change t to minus t, we get exactly the same equation. So there is nothing, there is nothing that we can use at this level that will allow us to say, again, we have this pictorial view that here would be the full solution of the possible metric variables, but then those satisfies the constraints would be living in here. We want to make sure that if we have some initial violation, we want to, as we go to the future, to get closer and closer to the surface of the constraint surface. If that's going to happen, now intuitively, we are going to have to break this time reversibility. Because we're saying, if we start with some initial violation, we want to go to the future, and we want to ensure that this one is driven to the constraint surface, then we're making a difference. If we go forward, we're going to get closer and closer, and backwards, likely we're going to get further and further away from the constraint surface. Of course, this one will not give it to us because this is time reversible, so we're going to be looking for a way to actually change that that behavior. So for that, let me consider the following thing. So I'm going to go back to that representation, and for the sake of the argument, let me ignore the first piece because that's the piece we like. Let me ignore the third piece. That's a piece that has that is a lower order term, so we can ignore. I'm going to just simply concentrate on that term. So RAB is equal to something plus this grad A comma B plus something else. We want to discuss this in general. So let's think that we're in this representation where we have said we have an extension, the generalized harmonic. We're setting that gamma B has to be equal to HB. But implicitly, we have introduced a constraint of this form, because at any given point, say you're given H by Hahn, that's what you're trying to force gamma to be. But now, if you calculate gamma from that, with from using the your metric variables, then these will not necessarily be equal to that. There will be some slight differences, and this is precisely the new constraints. So we're trading some constraints by those. Again, let me stress something that Franz has already said. When we take the harmonic or the generalized harmonic approach, we solve all of the equations. We solve for GTT, GTI, and GIJ. So in principle, the constraints, the Hamiltonian momentum constraints that we induce here are no longer there. Remember, the Hamiltonian momentum constraints were particular projections of the Einstein tensor or the Ricci tensor. So what we do is we traded the momentum and Hamiltonian constraint by this new constraint, which is this one. And in a few minutes, we'll relate these new constraints to the old ones in a particular way. So then I can, now we have these new constraints, are, let me call them CB, are equal to H. And for the sake of the argument, let me just do this with a minus sign, just for put a minus sign in front. So HB plus gamma B. So if we were satisfying the constraint that CB is exactly equal to zero, but now what we are going to do is we're going to allow the possibility that at some given time, either at the initial time level or sometime afterwards, there is a slight violation of the constraint. So our original equation, which is this, which we want to replace by when the constraints are satisfied. So if the constraints are satisfied, I can change, whenever I see gamma, I can trade it to minus H. But if the constraints are not satisfied, my true equation is given by RAB minus grad A CB equal to zero. Right, if I do this with the C here, what I'm doing is replacing the gamma with the H. So this is the equation that we're going to have, and we're going to ask the question, what happens if the constraints are not as satisfied? So if the constraints are satisfied, H is exactly equal to minus gamma. We can do this trading, and in the end, we're solving RAB equal the piece with gamma grad of H. But if the constraints are not satisfied, then what we're actually solving is this equation, which is penalizing the fact that we're not, or making evident the fact that we're not necessarily satisfying this equal to zero explicitly. So So how do we see what the behavior of these constraints will be? And this we'll see will mimic what we did before with the electromagnetic case. So what I'll do is the following. So let me take that equation. We know that, say, grad A RB minus 1/2 GBR has to be equal to 0 by Bianchi identities, right? That's a must. So we want to know what Bianchi identities will now determine or imply in terms of these equations that we're trying to solve. So what we do is we just operate with this. So here I have grad A, RIB minus 1/2, grad B of R. So I just simply operate with the nabla. And now what I'll do is every time I see RIB, I'm going to replace it by the symmetric derivative of C. So this is going to be equal to grad A. Grad A C B minus 1/2 grad B grad A C A. So now what we want to do, I want to see if I can get an equation which will tie or give me an evolution equation for C in a clean manner. I almost have it here. I have grad acting on C and grads acting on C here. But let me just try to combine things in a particular way. So I'll rewrite this as, say, grad A CB, 1/2. Plus 1/2, sorry, this is grad A. Grad A, grad B of CA, minus 1/2, grad B, grad A of CA. I'm now going to combine these two, because this one is actually pretty nice. I just have the box operator acting on C, right? This is nabla nabla acting on C. And here I have this combination. And what I can do is notice that this grad A, grad B, and this grad B, grad A, this is almost a Riemann tensor. So what I do is first I'm going to lower this index and raise this one. And here I have 1/2 grad A, grad B, minus grad B, grad A of CA. And this is equal to 1/2 grad A of CB plus RAB CA equal to 0. So I can simplify the 1/2s. So now I have box of C plus R times C equal to 0. So we can already use it in a straightforward manner to say, well, suppose we have an initial configuration where C is identically equal to 0. This equation will say that the box of C is equal to 0, which will say if we satisfy the constraints initially and we don't feed constraint violations from the boundary, the box of C will give us a solution that determining C equal to 0 at the future time. So if we satisfy it initially, at a later time, we will still be satisfying it. We can see that better by using once more this in here. So I can rewrite this again. As grad A of CB plus the And that tells us a further actually piece of information. Suppose C actually is violated initially to a very small number. This one shows C to second order. I have C times C. So this order, it's a higher order. This will be ordered epsilon squared if C is violated to order epsilon. This one is ordered only order epsilon, which would say, well, if we have some initial violation, if it's small, this equation should be preserving it to that level. But of course, we have this problem that we're going to do this numerically. So analytically, this is telling us that if they are preserved, they will stay preserved. If they are not preserved, but to preserved to a small tolerance value, analytically, it should still be preserved to that small tolerance value. But numerically, we're constantly creating numerical errors that will violate the constraints. And so then how they combine as we evolve forward to the future may make this actually blow up, and we want to, or the constraints to blow up, we actually want to exercise some change that will try to see if we can make this not time symmetric or time reversible, but actually make it such that as we go to the future, things are satisfied better and better. So incidentally, let me just now tie the new constraints to the old ones. Because what would this equation entail? Let me just again, this is box of CB plus grad A of CB, say A equals 0. If we want to obtain the solution of C here, I need to provide at the initial hypersurface, I need to provide it with CA and dt of CA. It seems that I have to give a lot of information. I have to give the constraints and the time derivative of the constraints to make it satisfied. But we'll see that we're not, well, before in the ADM decomposition, say, we had to give the constraints here, which was the momentum constraints and the Hamiltonian constraints. And this seemed like we had to satisfy four pieces of information, or so four equations. Here I have to somehow satisfy eight. Well, sorry, C8, not only the functions, but the derivative of the function. But we'll see that actually the information is redundant. We're not given eight pieces of information. Well, there we're given four. Here we're actually given four, just as we did before, plus four, which are coordinate conditions. So let me just show that. So remember the constraints in the 3+1. The constraints were projections, came from projections of GAB equals 0, say, along an A and B, or HAB and B and C. So what we had, the Hamiltonian constraint came from projections parallel to R, so it was NA parallel to N, sorry. NA, NB, JB gave us the Hamiltonian constraint. And the momentum constraints came from NA, HBC, so this gave us the momentum constraint, and this gave us the Hamiltonian constraint. So we're going to tie the new constraints written that way with these old ones. So I can define a four covector constraint by considering simply, which I'm going to call it MA, by considering GAB and B. Notice that the common theme in both is that at least we had to hit with one n vector. In one case we hit with two, in the other one we hit with just one. and projected the other one. So this momentum vector m is a four momentum vector, and the one that has a component along n is a Hamiltonian constraint, and the one that is orthogonal to n of the remaining free index will give us the momentum constraint. So one can prove very easily through algebra that this implies the following: nb grad b of ca is equal to twice this m that we defined this way plus so there is a one-to-one relation between the M constraints, which are the ones that we discussed in the, when we did the ADM decomposition, and these new constraints. And notice that M, if we give the constraints, so suppose we give constraints satisfying our previous discussion, and we satisfy the constraints at the first hypersurface, that is, we're satisfying C equal to 0, then the old constraints seen from the ADM plus coordinates immediately tell us the time derivative of the new constraints. So while here, in the previous discussion, it looked like we were given satisfying the three momentum constraints plus the Hamiltonian, we're satisfying four conditions. While here it seems that we're satisfying eight, that's in disguise. We also have four plus four coordinates set in a different way. When we had the M and the H's, implicitly, we actually had to choose the alphas and the betas, so those were the other four that here come explicitly all in the same bag, while here, in here we have separated the two. Okay, so now what I want to do, this that was just an aside, we want to modify the equations in a way that hopefully will have better properties with respect to constraints. So let us consider a different thing. So the first thing we notice was that we wanted to break somehow time reversibility. So we expect that whatever we do, we're going to have to somehow tell that we're moving forward to the future or backwards to the past. The only thing we have at our disposal that we know of is this vector n. That tells us if we're going along n, we're going to the future. If we're going the opposite direction to n, we're going to the past. So we want to modify this equation somehow with n that will now give us a sense of direction of time. So first, let me give you the idea of that, what we're trying to do, and then we'll see how it actually does what we want. So suppose we consider an extended Einstein equation system. In the following way, so this is what we had before. Now we want to add some pieces and know about the fact that we're moving in a particular direction. So I'm going to introduce a parameter. Let me call it gamma zero or gamma. That's a parameter that will allow us to toggle on and off these new terms that we're going to add. And we're going to define them this way. So we're adding a bunch of things here, but let me just say or comment on some very few obvious observations. So what we have in the first terms was something that was completely symmetric in between A and B. So whatever we add better be symmetric. We want to account for n, and we don't want to make it too complicated. So at most, we're going to change things that we want to have it react if the constraints are not satisfied. We want to make it be We want to have it such that if the constraints are satisfied, we didn't change the equation. So if we are in the constraint surface, we are still solving the equation we wanted. So it has to be proportional to C. We don't want it to be proportional to, I mean, higher powers of C or very complicated derivatives of C, because then that will change perhaps our hyperbolic problems, our hyperbolic properties. So if C appears differentiated one, it better not appear differentiated again. Otherwise, it will mess up whatever hyperbolic analysis we had done for this system. So C has to appear linearly, I mean, sorry, with no derivatives. We don't want to overcomplicate it, so we don't want to consider more than the, beyond the linear term. And we want it to be aware of n in order to satisfy the symmetry properties. So this is one combination we can do. And the other one is just have the metric multiplying by this nc and cc. So this combination does everything we set out to do. It's aware of the constraint violation. If the constraints are satisfied, we're back to our original equation. And now we have explicitly n. So let's see what we gain by considering this calculation. And what we'll do is essentially repeat the steps that took us here and just see how this equation, or rather this equation, is modified by that introduction. So we're going to take the divergence of this, again, of the whole term. We're going to use, once we have the divergence so far, we're going to use the divergence so far can be written in terms of divergence of the Ricci scalar and so on. And just by going progressively with the algebra, we can end up writing things in terms of just C. So let me just give you the steps. And again, when we take the R, if we have the average of R, we replace it back by everything else that we have. So here we have and now that if we have R, we can replace that R by everything that we have in here and combine things. So when, once we recombine all those terms, what we have is grad C of CA minus 2 gamma NB grad B of CA. So that's the evolution of the constraints that is induced by the evolution equations of the metric variables that we have chosen. So to repeat, when in the previous case, that was the evolution of equations of the metric variables that we wanted. That, coupled to the behind candidate entities, induced this equation for the constraints. By following exactly the same steps, now rather than this, we have this, which has some terms that are, of course, are common. So this term and that term we had before, but now we have this and that. And explicitly, now we have an equation, an evolution equation for C that knows about the M. So now we have broken the time reversibility. If we take T goes to minus T, we're going to pick up a minus sign here and a minus sign there, while it's, the other two terms would be exactly the same. So now we need to understand what this equation tells us. And for simplicity, let's assume that we have some, at some given moment, some initial violation, or some violation that is ordered epsilon. And let's look at the resulting equation to order epsilon and discard things that are epsilon squared. So this term I ignore, and so I ignore this R term. Those are two orders, terms that will give us order epsilon squared. And so that the only thing that remains is this part. And this is an equation that is actually not too complicated to evaluate. And we can do it in a simpler manner. We can say, let's imagine we take a very small neighborhood of a point or a region where the constraints are satisfied. In that very small region, let's assume that the metric is sufficiently close to flat. So this is essentially just the wave equation. So I have this second minus Laplacian of CA. And also, let's assume that at that given instance of time, we're choosing coordinates such that the shift is zero and the lapse is one. So this vector n that we defined before is simply ddt, right? It's a vector along the time direction. So this is equal to minus 2 gamma, essentially dt of c. Okay. To the linear term. So I have the derivative along n. Then I'm going to have another term that I have n with c. Let's assume that they are orthogonal to each other. And this is basically the driving equation. So this equation has this equal to zero, has now this that knows about the time derivative of the constraints. It knows the rate of change of the constraints with a free parameter, this gamma, that we can change to whatever sign we may want. Yes? Right, so we're assuming, so two things can happen. So suppose we have some initial small violation of at some given point, we have some violation of the constraint to some level. What we want to do is to ensure that as we go forward to the future, this violation gets smaller and smaller. So two things can happen. So if it doesn't get smaller and smaller, so these terms cannot be ignored and we have to put them there. So what we're assuming is that at that given instance time, they are sufficiently small that they are ordered, say you're violating the constraint, say to 1%. But then if this is 1%, this is 1% to 1%, so it's 100 times smaller. And so is that one. And so now we're going to say, well, momentarily we're going to ignore them and we're going to try to get that system that will make them smaller. So then our assumption that these guys were small is valid. So that's what, or if you want, we're doing a linearized analysis with respect to C. And if the analysis gives us an equation that will ensure that you stay at the linear level, then you were justified in ignoring those terms. If you had a growing solution, then you're not justified and you have to include them. But now we have sufficient freedom to choose this gamma for that to happen. So, I mean, one can convince that oneself that this is gonna be doing the job, but let me just give you the solution to a simpler problem. So suppose we're considering a problem that says C, tt, minus c, xx. Let's imagine that we're just in one dimension. This term is just 2 gamma at the time derivative of c. So that's going to be 2 gamma c, t equal to 0. To analyze that problem, we can say c, as we have done many times in the past, imagine a Fourier decomposition of that, and then plug this in here. When we do that, we're going to have from here, f, tt minus plus k square f minus 2 gamma f, t equal to 0. And the solution to this problem, let me just write it over there, will be f of t, some constant e to gamma plus square root of gamma square minus k square t plus some other constant e to the gamma minus square root of k square minus gamma square plus t. So now what we have done, I mean, we can always say, let's dial gamma to zero, and we're back to our original system. If we dial back gamma to zero, what we have is just oscillation. And it's what we said before, that we just had a Laplacian of C equal to zero. We had oscillations in time coupled to the e to the kx. It's telling us that for gamma equals zero, solutions are e to the I k, e to the I k x plus t plus e to the I k x minus t with constant 2, constant 1. So this is just either a perturbation moving to the left or to the right, and never increasing in amplitude. If it never increases in amplitude, and this is something related to what your question was, one could be worried that the nonlinear terms may introduce a significant change to that. But if we make them that at the linear level, we ensure that they're decaying, then we have a more robust scenario, because we're decreasing in amplitude. We're not just staying at the same amplitude as what happens when gamma is equal to 0. So if gamma is different from 0, we can say, well, let's choose gamma to be negative, and we're ensuring here that it's going to decay exponentially. And again, this was something that we did discuss in the electromagnetic case through different options, and this is one of the options that has been seen its way into the harmonic system. And very recently, people have started with the harmonic system, but then arm starting from here, from this equation, sorry, from that equation that we wrote there, you can say, well, let me take that equation and do the ADM decomposition that we had before. And now you end up with a new system of equations that looks like the ADM system, but has a few pieces that, again, try to drive down the constraint to 0. That's the set for Z. But it's something that's been investigated. So any questions about this? I mean, the main message here is not the particular method that was used, but it's a particular thinking that went into, okay, you realize you had that particular problem, you could analyze how the constraints would behave, and then if things are not behaving properly, then you go in and you know at least some ways of attacking that problem. And again, inherently into it was the need to break the time reversibility of the system. It was just the idea that, okay, if things are blowing up, we want to now introduce a particular asymmetry in the flow of your metric variables, such that by choosing how it would flow in an appropriate manner, if you're off the constraint surface, you're going to get back to it. Which, in the standard way, we couldn't have, because there is no inherent notion of time going forward or backward. Now I can give you a side question. So this is a simple puzzle. So think about it, and then if you have the answer, come talk to me. If you don't have the answer, come talk to me, and we can have some fun with this. So time answers the questions. Are time reversible? And I should say this is slightly a tricky question. So answer the questions, are time reversible? We know black holes can merge, right? So, and you've seen examples of that. But we also know, I mean, and just these, they can merge generically. Nothing strange has to happen for them to merge. But we also know, this is, say, Hawking-Ellis, black holes can't bifurcate unless you encounter a naked singularity. So the puzzle in a sense, and this is, as I said, is kind of a tricky question or a tongue-in-cheek question. If Einstein's equations are reversible, how come black holes can merge and not bifurcate? And okay, you should think about it. And then if you can say, okay, there is a problem, and the tricky question, and the tricky part is because I'm using black holes, but and so if you answer this, be as a corollary, think of a simple argument based solely in the principle of equivalence that says this can happen but not this. I'm going to leave it there. So you can think it now, we can talk now, or we can talk afterwards. But I think it's a cute question that is extremely good at confusing people in dissertation defenses. I've tested it. So let me just mention one more thing, and it's related to something that Franz said yesterday in his talk. And it's something we haven't talked too much or much at all, but just so that at least you know this for completeness. Because we said before and today as well that, say, in the ADM decomposition, the right piece of information to give to evolve forward to the future was to a state of the system that satisfied the momentum constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint. In this new way of saying things, we need to give this constraint C and the time derivative C, but we showed that the time derivative is given by the satisfaction of the constraints, which amounts to satisfying the particular coordinates that we have chosen, plus the momentum and the Hamiltonian constraint. So one way or another, we have to be able to define metric variables and the state of the system in general that satisfied the Hamiltonian equal to zero and the momentum equal to zero, say in vacuum again. So now let me just discuss very briefly what is the problem in actually making sure that this is the case. And this is something we also discuss in passing in the electromagnetic case. In the electromagnetic case, the initial state of the system had to satisfy dV equals zero and dE equals zero. So if you want to give consistent data, you had to give B and E, and from there we can go to the future. But if you want to satisfy the Maxwell's equations, it better be that you choose E and B that satisfies dV and dE equals zero initially. So there are different options one can go about. One is to say, this one equation, that's one equation, I'm going to pull out of a hat Ex and Ey, and for Ez, I just use this constraint equation to fix it. That's one way. But the other one is to try to be smarter or fancier, if whatever you prefer to call it. One is to say, well, I have one equation. Let me define a relation and then obtain a single equation that will fix all the components at once. So I can say, let me imagine that E is the grad of phi, and this you've done many, many times in electromagnetism, electrostatics. Then this equation coupled with this relation implies Laplacian of phi equal to zero. We solve Laplacian of phi with appropriate boundary conditions, and now we have the E. This analog problem in Einstein's equation is the following, and let me take that picture for simplicity. So we have a given hypersurface. We had gamma ij, the intrinsic metric to this hypersurface. And we have kij, the extrinsic curvature of this hypersurface. And we had that the Hamiltonian momentum constraints were given by so that was a Hamiltonian constraint. The momentum constraint was something like tau. So this is what we have to satisfy. But we have 12 pieces of information. We have 6 here, plus 6 there, and we have 4 equations to fix 12 components. So 8 are completely free. Very much like here, if we were trying to satisfy E, the divergence of E equal to zero, we had one equation for E, so we could give 2 for free, and 1 was completely determined by that equation. So we are in a similar situation. Of course, in this case, it's more involved, but it's similar. The system is underdetermined. we have fewer equations than things we need to fix. So we now need to make some choices. And some choices depend on what your physical, the ultimate physical problem is, which one is what you're going to decide to do. One can think is, one particular approach is to say, well, I want the simplest possible method that will give me a consistent physical picture with respect to the problem that I want to solve. And in the problem that Franz was showing yesterday, his goal, for instance, was to define a spacetime that contained a black hole and nothing else. So he just wanted to study a perturbed black hole. It wasn't that he wanted to study a very specific type of perturbed black hole. The only excuse was, I want a perturbed black hole, and I want to get it in the simplest possible manner. So the approach he used, and this is the one that everyone has been using for decades for doing this, and it goes back to the time of Jimmy York, is the following. Let us simplify this problem as much as we can. Try to make the most democratic choice for that, and see what the final system of equation is. So this is, would be like, when I call democratic, would be like this one. You say E is some gradient of phi. The alternative that we discuss is I give B X and B Y by hand, and I solve for B Z. Here you say, no, I'm going to treat all the components in the same way. They are going to be given by the gradient of some function, and then I solve for this phi. So the York approach to solving this problem was to say, first, consider a moment of time symmetry. That means that the way this surface is embedded in the full four-dimensional spacetime cannot distinguish between going to the future or going to the past. It's time symmetric at that given instant. So if it is time symmetric at that given instant, one can show that the extrinsic curvature is identically equal to zero. So that implies Kij is equal to zero. Because Kij is equal to zero, things have simplified tremendously. The momentum constraint equation is identically equal to zero. Right? The momentum is telling us implicitly how energy is moving in our spacetime. But if we're at the moment of time symmetry, whatever energy may be going, it may be going. We don't know if it's expanding or contracting. We're just catching it at that moment where there is no net flux of energy. So then this one gets satisfied identically. And the first equation, the Hamiltonian constraints, gets also satisfied, simplified a lot, because this guy goes away and that guy goes away. And now the only thing we need to show or need to satisfy is R is equal to zero, or whatever source we might have. In his case, he was putting some energy here, given by the scalar field. But so the goal that we have is satisfying R equal to something, where R is the three Ricci scalar of the Ricci scalar of the three hypersurface, three-dimensional hypersurface that we have. Of course, we haven't said anything about gamma ij. I knocked off six conditions by saying kij is equal to zero, but I have six more here, and I only have one equation. So somehow I still have to fix five pieces of information. Again, you could have said, you could say here, I'm going to choose gamma xx, xy, xz. I mean, pick five arbitrary components by hand and solve for the last one by plugging in this. But the easiest way, and it's something called the conformal flatness assumption, is to say that my matrix satisfies that relation. That my matrix is such that it's conformally related to the flat metric, and there is a conformal weight, this function phi, which will tell me how the space M is curved, but what I'm doing in a democratic way. I don't distinguish X from Y from Z. All the components are treated in exactly the same way. Why do we care about this? Is that with this assumption, once you plug it in the Ricci, the expression for the Ricci scalar is extremely simple. It basically will be saying Laplacian of phi plus some terms that are higher order in phi equal to rho. So you essentially end up with almost the Poisson equation with some small extra pieces, but you can solve them with the standard numerical techniques that have been devised for decades to solve this other problem, the electromagnetic problem. or the Newtonian problem for obtaining what the gravitational potential field is of a given matter distribution. And here you see precisely what the corrections brought in by general relativity are, which are precisely these terms that are in here. Because the case for the gravitational potential in Newtonian physics have been Laplacian of phi equal rho. Now we have these extra contributions. But these are terms that are not part of the principal part of the system and can be treated in a very generic way. And as I said, there is a whole literature about the initial value problem, and then there are some particular problems where this may not be the best thing you can want to do. For instance, suppose you're we try to do a rotating black hole. We can still choose this approach. What we would put here is some density that is very fastly rotating, and so that will induce a rotation of the spacetime. But there is a theorem that has been proved that the Kerr spacetime line, the Kerr spacetime cannot, is not conformally flat. So there is no conformal factor that you can choose that when you multiply by the eta, you get precisely Kerr. What you can get at best is Kerr with some amount of artificial radiation that is passing through that given hypersurface. And so while you could simplify your life as far as what initial value problem you have to solve, you may then have to live with the consequence of extra spurious physics that may not be what you're after. And so routinely, when you look at numerical simulations nowadays, we all have to face the same problem that we don't know precisely the state of the system, because if we knew precisely the state of the system, we wouldn't be doing the problem to begin with. So you put that the simplest possible way that is consistent with your physical intuition. So if you want, say, two black holes that are going around each other, you put the two black holes going around each other, and then you'll see that it's going to be some extra amount of radiation that is built in initially that comes out as a burst, but after a few rotations essentially leaves the domain and it's not no longer affecting the dynamics of the space then. But it is affects a little bit of what you thought were the initial masses you put in. Some of that radiation falls into the black hole, makes the black holes be slightly larger, and then, okay, you're now dealing with a different binary system that you than the one you wanted to put, but the differences are small, and you measure that. So you say, well, I'm no longer evolving two black holes of mass M1 and M2, I'm evolving black holes of mass M1 prime and M2 prime, and that's what you get. Okay, so with that, I think I'll stop here. So think about the puzzle, and if you have answers, let me know.